Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest this morning is Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis is a noted Middle East expert, an author of numerous books on Iraq, occupied Palestine, the UN, and America's quest for world dominance. She's also a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the Transnational Institute, where she specializes in Middle East and UN studies. Phyllis is a Middle East expert for sure, and she's written so much about it. She visits the area. She knows it so well. Oh, my goodness, there's so much going on there. Phyllis, are we connected?
We are indeed. Good to be with you.
Oh, you're coming in with a little blur.
I'm traveling at the moment, so I'm not sure I can get a better connection. I'm sorry for that.
We'll do the best we can. Sometimes, or if you're in a corner in a room, I can hear you. Oh, there's so much. Why don't we begin a little bit on the most recent violence? I'll throw a few things at you. Oh, the horrendous car bombings in Baghdad yesterday. Violence on the Temple Mount. I know it went on in September, stoked up again over the weekend. And then a report this morning in Afghanistan that two U.S. helicopters went down. My first thought is they were shot down, 14 U.S. Service people killed, I think some American civilians. The beat goes on, Phyllis.
What we're seeing in Iraq is more evidence, if anyone questioned it, that the war in Iraq continues. The war is not over. 130,000 U.S. troops still occupying Iraq. 150,000 U.S. paid mercenaries backing up the U.S. forces in Iraq. And what we're seeing now is more evidence that simply saying that the U.S. soldiers are withdrawing to certain bases is not a way of ending the war. It will not be ended until the U.S. soldiers are withdrawn, and I think that the fact that President Obama is so far abiding by the minimalist representation of the letter, if not the spirit, of the U.S.-Iraq agreement means that there is going to be continued fighting as long as those U.S. troops are there. Although there were not Americans killed in Iraq, it's again clearly linked to the existence of a widely despised U.S. occupation in that country. The violence in Afghanistan in the war, what we're being told is that it was a mid-air collision, either between two helicopters or a helicopter and something else. It was a bit vague. But that is certainly the consequence, again, of U.S. occupation and U.S. war. So I think that that's what we're going to have to be expecting as long as U.S. troops are remaining in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, in the debate that's going on in Washington, and the debate is a lively one about what the strategy in Afghanistan should be, the possibilities that are on the table seem to be limited to sending up to 40,000 new troops and expanding to a wide-ranging counterinsurgency strategy, or keeping the same number of troops, perhaps with a small escalation, and maintaining the counterterrorism approach, where there's not even the claim that the U.S. would be doing anything other than trying to kill bad guys, as they put it. That's going to continue.
That music needs a break. Let's take a brief break, and we'll come back and continue this.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Phyllis Bennis, talking about the untenable situation in the Middle East, occupied Palestine, Iraq, Afghanistan. Oh, I hear gurgling, burbling. We're still connected, Phyllis, right?
We are.
Maybe we are being monitored. Who can tell? One question I wanted to ask you, certainly all three areas, West Bank, Gaza, Iraq, Afghanistan. We're talking about occupied territories. The people in all three countries, areas, certainly are very, very unhappy about it. The Palestinians with more justification than anybody after 41 years, plus the horrors of over 60 years. It obsesses me. I know you feel exactly the same way. So we see eruptions from time to time, and we've had two intifadas. I wonder your thoughts on whether what's going on the Temple Mount might be a precursor to a third intifada.
I think the notion of a separate intifada, which is the Arabic word for shaking out or shaking up, it was the word that was chosen back in 1987 to describe the uprising that began in December of that year. I don't know if we're going to see something of the same nature. The first and second intifadas were very different. The first intifada was a very grassroots-driven, nonviolent rising up against the occupation that at that point had been going on for 20 years. The engagement of civil society was crucial. The engagement of women's organizations, students' organizations, even children, healthcare workers, guard committees that were formed, popular mourning committees that were formed, as well as a locally based indigenous leadership that was known as the UNLU, the Unified National Leadership of the Uprising. The second intifada, and of course that intifada faded with the coming of the Oslo process, when there was hope that many held that the Oslo process would lead to the creation of a Palestinian state. As we all know, it didn't. Led to, in many ways, a worsening situation with the rise of settler expansion at a much higher level. The second intifada that began in 2000 began, ironically enough, with a visit to the Temple Mount area by Ariel Sharon, then the defense minister of Israel, in a very provocative move to buy 100 or so soldiers. That intifada was very different. It was an armed uprising. It involved far fewer people among the Palestinians themselves. And again, it also failed to create a Palestinian state or to create equality between Israelis and Palestinians in all of the territory that Israel now controls. So I don't know that it's going to take the form of another identifiable uprising, but I think that what's clear is that nonviolent resistance has been on the rise for quite a long time, both at the level of mobilization of protesters, Palestinian, Israeli, and international, at the wall, the apartheid wall that Israel has built across the West Bank on a weekly basis, and most importantly, the rise both, really around the world, of what is known as the BDS campaign, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, which is a crucial way of bringing nonviolent economic pressure to bear on Israel to force an end to these violations of international law and human rights. This is a campaign that's a big part of the work of the U.S. campaign to end Israeli occupation. The group in the U.S., a big coalition of 325 or 350 organizations that are working to engage U.S. towards a new policy of ending occupation and supporting equal rights. So I think that what we're looking at is the continuous rise of nonviolent pressure. In this case, it was a mobilization on the Temple Mount to protect the Muslim holy sites, the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, from groups of Jewish settlers who had threatened to try and invade those holy spaces. And it, of course, led to a large level of violence when Israeli police and soldiers brought weapons in and tried to break it up. So I think that what was a continuing rise, I think that what's going to be more important in the near term is this international mobilization that's aimed at stopping the current U.S. position of enabling the Israeli occupation, protecting Israel and the United Nations. This, of course, is the key factor of response to the Goldstone report, the report that was drafted by the South African Justice Richard Goldstone with the mandate of the UN Human Rights Council, in which the United States has promised to prevent any serious ability on the, you know, for the war crimes that were perpetrated in Gaza in December and January during Operation Cast Lead. And it's for this reason that the UN is now taking up the challenge again to see if they can move in a way that will bring real accountability nearer to reality. The U.S. has said that they see the Goldstone report as fundamentally flawed, but as Justice Goldstone said on the Bill Moyers show on PBS the other night, so far no one has actually challenged any factual allegation in it. They've said it's biased, it's this, it's that, but nobody has actually said that anything in it is not true. So I think this is what we need to be keeping the pressure on for our work here in the United States, pressuring the U.S. to allow the United Nations agencies to take seriously the effort for accountability for war crimes, both by Israel and the Palestinians, as mandated by the Goldstone Report, and secondly, to mobilize the BDS campaign to keep the pressure on Israel directly to ensure pressure towards ending the violations of international law.
So as I absolutely agree with you, a few months back I had a program on the BDS movement. Oh, I think it is so important just to keep that going, let it grow, let that grassroots pressure build, and at some point just demand a solution. And my feeling about the Goldstone report, the fact that a man, a distinguished man like Judge Goldstone was behind it, and the UN Human Rights Council endorsing it, I think it's got the Israeli officials in Washington a little bit nervous that this thing may have some
traction. Absolutely. What I'm worried about is two things. One is the possibility war crimes indictments may be issued by other countries if the UN is not allowed to go forward because of U.S. veto. And that would mean that U.S. officials could not travel. For example, just about a week ago, the Israeli defense
Are we disconnected? Oh, I lost you, Phyllis. Okay. Oh, I do think the Goldstone report is awfully important. I did an article on it, and there are others as well. They really add that much more emphasis to the Goldstone report. I'll mention it when Phyllis comes back, but even organizations that don't quite come down as hard on Israel as they should, Human Rights Watch, they usually support Israel, the worst of their crimes. Amnesty International, a tiny bit better. They were pretty damning in some of the stuff that they put out after the Gaza War, Operation Cast Lead. And then the Goldstone Report, maybe being the crowning report, the most damning because of who Goldstone is. And it got prominence. Well, the U.S. media wants to play it down and bury it and forget about it. New York Times in the lead on that. Are we reconnected, Phyllis? Oh, dear. Well, we will keep trying. She may be in a spot where that may not be the easiest to connect. Let me know when you've got her back again. But this is vital. This is a topic that I revisit all the time on this program and in my own writing. And in one article, some months back, I quoted the CIA saying the situation, what Israel is doing is untenable, that there are lots of prominent Jews leaving the country. They don't want anything to do with this anymore. And if I remember the quote, it was something like, given 20 years from now, Israel then won't be the Israel it is now, and it will not be what Israeli officials today want it to be. So Israel, I guess, if they're right, Israel is maybe slowly self-destructing. Stuff as extreme as what they do simply can't go on forever. Same as the U.S. Our activities are so extreme, so destructive, they can keep it going a good while, longer than a lot of people ever would want or maybe expect. But sooner or later, this stuff has to end. Maybe bankruptcy is the answer. Phyllis, we're reconnected.
Hello?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Okay,
we
got disconnected. I just carried on until I could get you back. I was emphasizing the importance of the Rollstone report, and also there are other reports that, along with it, even Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, John Dugard, the former UN Human Rights Rapporteur for Palestine, he did one mid-year. I had him on this program earlier in the year, and I knew that report was coming. He couldn't talk about it then, but it came out, I think, around June. And there have been others. I mean, all damning Israel and its war crimes.
Yeah, the importance of the Goldstone report is not so much in what's in it, because, as you say, there's been a number of reports, and they've all been consistent. There's nothing in the Goldstone report that we didn't know already. What's significant about it is, one, how comprehensive it is. It's 575 pages long. It deals with, and it is important, I think, that Justice Goldstone's team dealt with human rights violations carried out by the Palestinians as well, although they are, of course, dwarfed by those of Israel.
We got to take another break. Let's do that. If we get disconnected again, we'll just call you back, Phyllis.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis, I did want to check with you if before the hour is up you have to break away. Let me know, and there's no problem whatsoever. But if you've got the time, hopefully we can go right to the top of the hour. But I know you're always on the go, and and if I have to, I can carry the ball. I want to talk about Iran as well. Maybe we can do that after the break on the bottom of the hour, 30-minute break. There's no question that the prominence of Goldstone makes his report so important. All that information, you're right. I mean, it's been floating around voluminously. Anybody can get their hands on it, especially Operation Cast Lead. My God, there's all kinds of stuff on exactly a chapter and verse on what happened. And I agree, he tried to be even-handed by talking about Palestinian war crimes, but my honest to goodness, I guess that was important to do, but I think he had to bite his tongue and say, well, you know, I had to do this, otherwise they'll think I'm completely one-sided and biased. But international law is pretty clear. When you're attacked, you've got a right to respond. And in 2008,
we should be clear, though, Justice Goldstone fought for the extension of the mandate to include Palestinian violations. It wasn't just pro forma, and it's not an unlimited right. There is the right of an occupied population to resist a military occupation using military means. That right does not extend to attacking civilians. So the attacks on Israeli cities are indeed illegal. But of course, the inability to do any serious targeting, luckily the rapid fire led to very few casualties. So, of course, the vast majority of the documentation involved Israeli violations, and they were horrific and led to the deaths of more than 1,400 Palestinians, of whom more than 900 were civilians, and 330 of them were children. So that's very important. But beyond that, what's important, the Goldstone report, I think, is the breadth of his recommendation, that he recommends not only what the Human Rights Council should do, how the Security Council, if Israel and the Palestinians don't sufficiently investigate their own violations, the Security Council should refer the cases to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, that the what the General Assembly should do. But beyond all of that, he talked about what individual government should do and civil society. He said that civil society should be mobilizing to pressure their government to use the principles of universal jurisdiction to bring potential war crimes to trial. And as I mentioned earlier, just about a week ago when the Israeli defense minister was in Israel, went to London on a private trip, a fundraising trip, he was met by an effort in the British court to use universal jurisdiction as the basis of holding him, arresting him, trying him for war crimes. And it took the British courts 5 hours to finally decide not to do that. And the only reason they didn't was because they changed the nature of his trip from a private trip to a state visit, and said because of that they would give him immunity. But it indicated that it's an ongoing real issue whether Israeli officials will be able to travel around the world raising money or whatever else, or whether they will risk being arrested wherever they might go. That's a huge development in terms of the role of civil society and of other governments, and it's, I think, a very, very important one.
Well, we can only hope, Phyllis, that U.S. officials will be just as concerned. And my understanding for some time is Henry Kissinger, before he goes abroad, has to check with the State Department to be sure he's not a wanted man where he's planning to travel.
That's right. I'm losing you again. I think I'm going to have to sign off at this point.
you've got to go?
I'm not hearing you, and I'm afraid we're coming into another zone, so I think I'm going to have to sign off.
Oh, my goodness. My goodness. Well, Phyllis, I thank you very, very much. Oh,
thank you.
Maybe we could do this again when we get you on a landline.
We'll try. Thanks.
Okay, Phyllis, thank you so very much. Oh, we will continue. I believe Phyllis is on her way to the UN, and that's the reason we've been using a cell phone. Sometimes we get better reception, sometimes worse, so we do the best we can. Landlines are more dependable, but we do the best we can. The Middle East certainly is such a vital topic, and there's a conflict in the countries that we're involved in. The ones that I wanted to talk about on this program today, Occupy Palestine. I wanted to get into the peace process a little bit with Phyllis. There really hasn't been a legitimate peace process since the notion first was raised some years back. A lot of talk, no action. You can't have peace if you don't have a partner to have it with. And the Palestinians absolutely want peace. They've wanted it for many years, maybe going back to the 1970s, certainly in the 1980s. And Israel absolutely then did everything possible to avoid it. And they've done everything possible since. I remember vividly 1993, the Oslo Accords, and it was nothing but a sellout. Arafat was in exile in Tunis. He wanted to come back. He made, he did what he thought was best for himself and his cronies. Unfortunately, he, in plain English, screwed his own people. And the present Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, he was involved in those negotiations, and he had the same agenda, you know, help themselves. They did fine from what they agreed to, but it was absolutely atrocious. It was a one-way deal. Let's take another break, and we'll come back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I will carry the ball to the top of the hour. Oh, let me just make one comment about Phyllis. Phyllis is an extraordinary woman, an expert on the Middle East. She travels there often. She knows the area. She writes extensively about it. So we could spend the whole day talking with her about this and getting the benefit of her expertise on one country after another, and it really is so much. I knew that very possibly she'd need to break away because she was in transit as we got her on the program this morning. So we do the best we can, and we had her for half the program, which last time I had her on, I think we had her for about 20 minutes. And again, she was on the move, and she had to break away, and I had a second guest on the same topic, so we simply continued the discussion then. But I'll get her back, and we'll do it again, and we'll have another conversation about what's going on, what's most prominent in the region at that point in time. But it's not good. Two occupied countries, Iraq and Afghanistan. You've got the occupied territories of Palestine, long unrelieved grievances that need attention. Sooner or later, something's going to happen. I hope I live long enough to see it. And these all three situations simply can't go on. And then we've got Iran. In my mind, it's been touch and go whether there'll be another conflict there. I think it would be an absolute calamity if it happens. Very possibly the entire region could erupt, and Iran, they don't have nuclear weapons, but they're a stronger country than Iraq was in 2003 when we attacked them. I mean, we wrecked Iraq both in the 1980s, the war with Iran, and then the Gulf War, and then the sanctions. I mean, the country was absolutely wrecked. They weren't an opponent. My goodness, I think the Chicago Police Department could have gone in and bowled them over it in 2003. So, you know, you do some shock and awe, and you send in the Marines, and it was a walkover. But it's not a walkover against the resistance. I mean, they certainly couldn't go head-to-head with U.S. forces. But they lay back and they pick their spots. Same thing in Afghanistan. Those people are determined to get rid of their occupiers, and one day they will in both countries. And one day the Palestinians will as well. But a lot of people are being hurt grievously, dying every single day. And the car bombings in Baghdad over the weekend, killing all those people. That's a statement against an illegal occupation. Those people want us out. Iraqis want us out. And what we did to that country, my God, they deserve a lot more than getting us out. We can literally never, never repay them for what we did to their people, to their country. A century from now, we won't be able to repay them for what we did to them. And Afghanistan, my God, Afghanistan has had so many decades of conflict going back so long intermittently that they probably suffered as much as any people on earth. And there have been lots of people that have suffered so very, very much anyway. Heaven help us if we have a conflict with Iran to ratchet up even more what's going on now. Oh, let me raise another topic, too. I was looking for an email that I can't put my hands on. Quick comment on the swine flu situation. I'll have a program. I'll mention this. I'll have a program on the 3rd of November. I will have a woman on who's possibly the world's most noted vaccine expert, Dr. Vera Schreibner. She lives in Australia. We come on at 10 a.m. U.S. Central Time. In Australia, I've got to double-check the time to be sure. We go on Standard Time November 1. In the U.S., and I believe her time in Australia will be the next day at 3 a.m. in the morning. And she thinks the situation is so serious that she's willing to come on at that hour. So that will be the time for her, and we'll discuss the dangers of vaccines. We'll discuss the dangerous swine flu vaccine. And the hype is beginning, reports of outbreaks of swine flu, people dying, kids getting sick, so on and so forth. Well, I hope listeners to this program know that there's no danger from swine flu. Even the World Health Organization and CDC in their rare, honest moments will admit it really isn't any different than seasonal flu. And you certainly never see scare headlines on that. And the people who perish from it have some kind of other problems. Oh, they're old, they're ill, whatever. And if the flu doesn't get them, something else will. That's the same situation with swine flu. It's not the flu that's the problem. It's the vaccine that I call a bioweapon, which I absolutely believe it is, and people absolutely have to avoid it. Well, that's a big divergence from the Middle East, something a little closer to them. Anyway, we'll have a discussion with Vera Schreibner when she comes on. And I'm really looking forward to that. I hope she's got a good alarm clock. But we will certainly do our best to get her on. And I would say a sleepy Vieira would be better than most other people I can bring on. She has done extensive research on vaccines. And if I remember one thing that I read that she wrote, there was a time way back when she thought vaccines were safe, and then she started doing her research and did it quite extensively, and was surprised and shocked, I imagine, to discover that what she believed in just wasn't so. This stuff is very, very dangerous, and it often causes the illnesses they're designed to prevent. And all vaccines need to be avoided, but she's the expert. I'll let her explain it, not me. I'm only expert at quoting the experts. If I can be, that may be a poor way of saying it. Anybody is an expert at quoting experts. Just go find out what they say and what they've done, and then just quote them verbatim. Anybody can do that. So I'm one of many people who does. I put out a new article today, part of a little bit closer to what's going on in the Middle East, which affects Muslims worldwide. And they are the target of choice, and along with our Latino immigrants, no question about that. So I've done a fair amount of writing on both of them, and I've written two recent articles on the constant campaign against Muslims in the U.S. who are targeted, not because they're criminals, but they're accused of terrorism, conspiracy to commit terrorism, all kinds of plots that are concocted. FBI paid informants, some of them so extremely well paid it's hard to believe. Some of them can be paid well in excess of $100,000 over a period of so many months, could go on for 2 years, 3 years. These people are well paid. Usually people picked who have charges against themselves, and the FBI pays them to cooperate, guarantees them leniency, maybe total absolution, whatever, but certainly leniency, in return for them to go up against somebody else that they want to target. So I wrote about several of them. I discovered a website that I recommend people check out, the FBI Weekly. It comes out on Saturdays. They have a weekly website of the top 10 stories of the week, which includes all the bad guys they're going after. So they do it. It's through the week ending on Friday, and it's available on Saturday. I spotted the one ending the 25th of September, and I was absolutely stunned to see the top six stories of the top 10 were all Muslim men charged with those crimes, allegations of terrorism or conspiracy to commit terrorism, and several of them were getting headlines in the media. And the absolute number one guy was a young man by the name of Najibullah Zazi. Well, I wrote about him and the other five, and I absolutely believe they are all absolutely innocent. They had no intention to commit any crime, but yet they all have a very tough road to hoe because the prosecutors are very expert at bringing out trumped-up charges, nearly always using what they call classified information that is not made available to defense, so there's no way to refute it. And they intimidate juries to convict these people because nobody wants to risk having a terrorist in your neighborhood. Although the chance of that, I think the chance of being affected by an erupting volcano halfway around the world would be a much greater threat than running into a terrorist in your neighborhood. Or maybe in Chicago, slipping on the ice in the winter and breaking a limb or something or other, or being careless and getting hit by a car crossing the street against the lights. There isn't much of a chance you're going to run into a terrorist in your neighborhood, but prosecutors scare the dickens out of juries to believe all kinds of crazy stuff. And the media goes along as a co-conspirator, hyping these stories. But if you listen carefully to media reports about any of these people, try hearing anything that's even close to smoking gun evidence that these people intended to commit any crime or committed any crime. It's usually allegations about intentions, not actual crimes. So this fellow Zazi, a New Yorker, moved to Colorado. Supposedly he bought bomb-making substances. Where did he buy them? In a beauty shop. Not the usual place where people buy bomb-making materials. And they said he had a plan to go back to New York on or around 9/11, this past 9/11, on the anniversary, and set off a major terror attack. Well, he went back to New York. He drove back. And on 9/11, he used to be a vendor, a street vendor, selling snacks and stuff. He went back to the spot where he did his vending And on 9/11, he just went back to visit, see who was around. He ran into some of his old regulars, and they were joking and laughing. No plot, no crime, no bombs. These bomb-making materials he supposedly bought, he drove from Colorado to New York, and he took nothing with him. Conclusion? There was no plot. There were no bomb-making materials. There was no bomb. And he went back to New York for other reasons. Unfinished business. There's a family, see old friends. People take trips all the time for various reasons. Taking a trip doesn't mean you have a plan to commit a terrorist attack. Well, I absolutely don't believe he intended to do anything. And I think the other five I wrote about were exactly the same thing. My new one this morning was on the latest guy that got headlines for 2 or 3 days. A young man, and they misspelled his name. The media called him Tarek, T-A-R-E-K, Mahana. Oh, the middle of last week or so, there were headlines all over the media about this guy plotting, what else, another terror attack. His name is Tariq, T-A-R-I-I-Q. He's of Egyptian heritage, but he's an American. He went to the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy. Did some prominent things in his community, which was Sudbury, Massachusetts, an affluent Boston suburb. He was approached 2 or 3 years ago to be an informant. In other words, to be wired, to record conversations, to entrap other Muslims the FBI wanted to get, and he turned them down. And my feeling is that's what made him a target. He planned nothing. I can find, again, no plot, no weapons, no scheme, nothing. And yet he was arrested, and he will face charges, and he will go to trial, and the prosecutors are very clever. They'll probably intimidate the jury to convict him, even though, as far as I can see, I can't find any evidence that he planned to do anything. So my conclusion is he's absolutely innocent. He is another innocent Muslim being targeted. And my favorite tagline is, it's the wrong time to be Muslim in America. It absolutely is. It never was a good time. But probably this is the worst time. So that's what he's up against. He was arrested at Boston's Logan International Airport. He was offered a job in Saudi Arabia to be a pharmacist. And it's I didn't get the exact details, but apparently the pay was good. The Saudis can sure afford it, or whoever runs the pharmacies over there. The pay was good, the benefits were good, and he was promised free trips back to visit his family. And for whatever reason, he wanted to go. Well, that's no crime. Anybody can go to another country and take a job. Perfectly legitimate. And he wanted to be a pharmacist, not a jihadist. So he went to the airport. He was going over. He went to Logan Airport, and they arrested him at the airport. So they're holding him now without bail. So that's his situation. And as soon as I spot a headline like this, and I would alert everybody, the next time you spot a headline about another Muslim accused of terrorism or conspiracy to commit it, absolutely feel right off the top, this guy, it's usually a man, once in a blue moon, a woman, and I had a program on one some months back. And in her case is the worst one of all, that they actually destroy the humanity of this woman. And they'll do it against anybody, because they'll lock you up, deny you bail, pretrial. After the arrest, an indictment will come down. They get a grand jury to indict, and then some months later they'll bring you to trial. It could be a good number of months later. It could be a few months later. It could be a year later. And they'll lock you under very, very harsh conditions, whatever the city they arrest you in. And they'll keep you there. And they won't make it easy for you to have counsel. They may restrict the amount of time that you have with him. They may monitor illegally your conversations with counsel. And they'll do everything possible to see to it that they get you convicted. Even though it's nearly dead certain that you haven't done a thing, don't have any intention of doing a damn thing. So that's my feeling about Tariq Mahana. And it goes on and on. There are lots of them. I'd have to go digging and find names that maybe I'll recollect somebody from the past. I can't write about all of them, but I want to write about some of them. And it's appalling that this goes on in this country. So these people are target one. And, of course, undocumented Latino immigrants are targeted all the time. And they're not charged with terrorism, at least not most of them. But they can be rounded up. They can be put in very harsh conditions temporarily and then deported. Maybe the lucky Muslim ones are deported and not charged with terrorism, imprisoned, and then forced to serve a very, very hard time. So this is outrageous stuff that goes on. None of us should tolerate it. And it makes me feel very definitely, my other tagline is, with this going on so flagrantly, we're all equally vulnerable. Let's take another break and we'll finish up the hour.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour, final segment. Let me just mention an article that was just sent to me, an email just popped up in my inbox. Apparently it was an article in the Chicago Tribune, which is surprising they would have an article like this. But the article is, I believe this is the title, Iraqi Refugees in Chicago, Abandoned, Adrift, Enduring. And the first line reads, weary Iraqi refugees describe how life in Chicago and America has left them with very little hope. Above that is a quote from a Greg Wangiran. He's the executive director of Interfaith Refugee and Immigration Ministries, among several Chicago nonprofit organizations that help refugees. And so little is being done for these people, and their needs are so great, and nobody apparently gives a damn. And he says, quote, I'm ashamed. I feel like I'm selling a lie. Well, that's the whole quote. In other words, people coming here just to get out of the terrible situation they're in, caused by this country making these people feel, or many, many, maybe most feel, that this is the last country they ever want to come to after what this country did to theirs. I mean, if we caused so much hardship there, killed so many people, we obviously don't give a damn about Iraqis. So why would we care about them here? And that's exactly what's happening. From this article, I just quickly glanced through that they come here, and basically they just kind of cut adrift on their own. And there's a quick comment that. Apparently, for a good many of them, they end up homeless. You don't want to be homeless on the streets with the Chicago winter approaching. But apparently, that's the situation. And again, nobody cares. And one more thing to be concerned about. And if anybody thinks that the Obama administration will act any differently than the Bush one, well, I hope you realize that the continuity was seamless. Except in my judgment, things have gotten worse, not better. And I think they'll get even worse looking ahead. So it's a very dire situation. Innocent people hurt at home and abroad. Foreign wars continuing. The nation's resources devoted to them in greater and greater amounts. Plus the ungodly amounts being directed at people who got us into the domestic problems that we're in. The criminal class on Wall Street. So much of this going on, and so much that this program addresses all the time, and the only solution, obviously, I hope everybody knows, is it certainly isn't going to come from those on top. They will fight tooth and nail to see to it that, that things stay exactly this way and actually get worse. The only way out of this is if enough people realize that unless we do it ourselves, it never will happen, because that's the only way it ever happens. But sometimes amazing things happen when enough people put their minds to it. There's a lot of great quotes I know. I remember I can't spit them out verbatim, But one or more of them goes something like, it's absolutely amazing what a small number of committed people can do when they set their minds to it. Just imagine if a much greater number of committed people set their mind to it, what we all can accomplish. Well, you know, that's the task, and it's about time we got around to doing it. And I'm certainly committed in what I do. I'm not talking about the blood on the streets. All that gets you is more blood on the streets. But when enough of us want to do it, then we are really the unchallengeable superpower. So let's start doing it. Thanks again for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow. James Petras is on tomorrow. Join us then.